The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, three teams have won all of their games. Liverpool with Alisson grabbing the headlines for a sensationally slow Cruyff turn. Chelsea with no one really grabbing the headlines. And Watford, this season's surprise package until they disappear in January, sack their manager in March and start all over again next season. Meanwhile, the crisis is over at Old Trafford and has been passed well and truly to the London Stadium. West Ham are pointless. Elsewhere, England's women qualify for the World Cup. There's some high quality officiating in Partick, a Spaniard biting someone's head, and another chance for me to say Roland de Châtelet. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Paolo Bandini, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm pretty good, actually.
Excellent news. John Bruin, hello, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Yeah, marvellous. And Barry Glendenning. Chris Evans has left the Radio 2 breakfast show. Is it time for a laconic Irishman to step up to the plate?
Well, we were discussing this, the possibility of you, me taking over,
yeah.
And it would mean I wouldn't get to write the rumour mill anymore, and I'm not sure I could live with that.
Okay.
That wrench.
So, are you, so just to be clear, you're ruling yourself out?
I'm not ruling myself out of anything.
Okay.
How many years have you been writing the rumour mill? When was your first?
Oh, don't. Let's not go there.
What's your favourite rumour?
most of them are too scurrilous to print or broadcast, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, that's it. Maybe we'll do a secret track. Producer Jonathan did a secret track on the last pod. I was very excited, and it went down very well. So if you do a scurrilous rumour, we'll leave it till the end, and then you can't get sued. Let's begin with the teams who've won all their games. Leicester 1, Liverpool 2. John, what did we learn from Liverpool here?
Well, the thing is that Liverpool have won their games, and they haven't played very well. And they look a work in progress. I'm not sure that taking Naby Keita out of the team for Jordan Henderson was particularly successful. But the talking point of the game, obviously, is the goalkeeping howler. Now, a lot of the times with goalkeepers, you get this situation where people say, "Oh, that was going to happen for ages," but it's happened really quickly. So you've got this dodgy keeper situation. I think the week before he attempted something. A bit too much flair when coming out of the box. This time, as you said, the slow Cruyff turn. And the other thing is, though, when the goal actually goes in, Leicester took an absolute age to put the ball back in. And Alisson's dive to get the ball was like he had forgotten how to be a goalkeeper when it's hit towards him. And he sort of dives over it as if the adrenaline overload of making such a mistake had just made him completely lose his faculties. I'm told, actually, in Italy, at the start of his time with Roma, he perhaps wasn't a completely safe pair of hands.
Paolo?
Well, at the start of his time in Italy, he was second fiddle to Wojciech Szczesny. He sort of arrived there as Brazil's number one and didn't go straight into the team. So it's certainly been a very rapid ascent in one season to the point where you can command the sort of fee he did. I can't remember off the top of my head what they actually paid for him, but lots and lots of money. Look, in a season as a starter at Roma, he actually didn't really have a blunder like this. He didn't, and he did sort of plenty of audacious things. He did plenty of taking his chances and beating attackers. My personal feeling on it is you sort of have to accept that as part of what you're getting. I don't think you can say to him, suddenly don't play the ball with your feet. You've made a mistake and now that's going to be a part of your game you've got to eliminate. Because why would you spend as much money as Liverpool did on him if you don't want that? If that's not part of your vision for how you're going to play the game, is to have a keeper who can, exactly as Klopp said afterwards, Klopp's reaction to it was, of course he was being positive and trying to not knock his player down, but saying, well, it's good that he got the mistake out of the way and now we don't have to worry about the first one. But also saying it's good if teams see this and think they want to press him, because that means every time they're committing a player to him. And that's exactly what the idea is. It's the idea of this sort of modern way of a goalkeeper playing and being someone who contributes to the build-up play is you oblige the opposition, if they're going to press, if they're going to come after you, to commit an attacker to you. And that gives you a numerical advantage further up the pitch. That's the point. It doesn't excuse the slowness of the turn. It doesn't mean he didn't make a mistake. And the fact that it's sort of coming off the back of nearly making a mistake in a very similar way last week, it doesn't look great. But yeah, I think you can sort of condemn the mistake without saying, well, now we need to tear up what Alisson is and the sort of player that he's supposed to be just for the sake of that?
It's difficult, Barry, because I obviously don't want to be viewed as a footballing dinosaur. You know, I'm not ready to be put in the proper football men category, but the footballing dinosaurs are just saying, clearly, just put that into row Z, let it go out for a corner, kick it out for a throw, whatever. And the ultimate footballing hipsters are saying, this is just what happens. You know, you've got to take the rough with the smooth. But sure, he should have just cleared that.
I think so. If he'd cleared it, Leicester wouldn't have scored and Liverpool wouldn't have, you know, had a tense end to the game. But I don't think it's that big a deal. Goalkeepers make mistakes. I don't think, he doesn't strike me as the kind of guy whose confidence it will affect. And Liverpool won the match. It's not a problem. But yeah, I have seen on Twitter various people saying that, you know, if he turned and pulled off the turn, you know, he'd have had the whole other side of the field to open, launch a counter-attack. But if he'd hoofed it into row Z, Leicester wouldn't have scored. It seems like a no-brainer to me. But I will bow to the superior knowledge of these fellow non-goalkeeping experts.
Firmino got his first of the season, pretty easy header. Mane's on form. Salah did miss a very easy chance, didn't he? Which we expected the net to bulge. But you're right, John, they are, I think, like all the teams that have won all their games or are near the top of the Premier League, no one has hit the ground flying like City did last year.
Watford have.
Apart from Watford,
obviously.
I'm discounting Watford.
Well, we're in post-World Cup scenario, aren't we, really? None of those teams have had a full pre-season in the way that managers would like. And the way that Pep Guardiola was able to have with his Manchester City players last season. So if you're a manager like Jurgen Klopp or Maurizio Sarri, who actually, you know, had less than a month to work with these players, it's all going well. And there's, if your work in progress is a perfect record, you're doing pretty well, aren't you?
In the Champions League, draw was made after we did the pod on Thursday. Liverpool are with PSG, Napoli and Red Star Belgrade. It's a nice group, Paolo, that, isn't it?
Nice group for fans to enjoy watching. Not a nice group if you want nice plain sailing to the group, to the last 16, no.
For the neutrals.
For the neutral, group. Lovely group. Yeah, should be entertaining.
Nice to see Red Star Belgrade back as well. I did a column in them in today's paper. It's their return to the Champions League for the first time in 26 years.
How much of a test will Napoli be?
Really hard to say what to make of Napoli at the moment. They got thumped 3-0 this weekend by Sampdoria. And, you know, just last weekend I was sort of... Well, I wrote my column last Monday praising the way that Ancelotti has sort of taken situations in hand, the tactical changes he was making on the fly in sort of two consecutive games start of the season. They went behind and then came back to win. Seemed like he was making really smart adjustments. And then this was the weekend when, yeah, they once again started slow and didn't manage to turn it around. They're a work in progress. I mean, that team was... in the same way that Chelsea already are, that team went through Jorginho last year. We can talk about Sarri and losing Sarri ball and all the rest of it, but in sort of simple on-pitch terms, they no longer have the player who touched the ball most for them last season, and they're trying to fill that gap. They've tried Marek Hamšík in the middle of it. They tried Zielinski this weekend. That part of their game is still uncertain. They have still looked very compelling going forwards at times. They've still got a lot of the muscle memory of, frankly, what they've done on Saturday. They've still got Dries Mertens, Lorenzo Insigne, Arkadiusz Milik had quite a good start to the season. They're more than capable of coming out of that group. But they are, at this point, a team that's still working out its identity, I'd say, under Ancelotti.
Chelsea do have Sarri, and they do have Jorginho. They've got a 100% record, 2-0 over Bournemouth. I think, Paolo, a few weeks ago, you were very worried about Chelsea, and you said this could be a total disaster. Do you have a humble pie, or are you still saying it possibly could be?
I mean, someone's now going to pull up an audio clip proving that I'd said exactly that. I find it unlikely that I said Chelsea are going to be a total disaster. I said I thought it was a tough spot for Sarri to walk into. But look, they've been very good. They have clearly sort of... Sarri has brought some of the same optimistic vibes that he brought to Napoli, which I think is an underrated thing in football sometimes. Make your players enjoy their football and the results will often follow. And I think that you see that Eden Hazard in particular is enjoying his football. And I think that when you have a system that encourages him to feel free, that encourages him to I guess, without sort of wanting to oversimplify, worry a little bit less about the sort of the fine details of a tactical system, which I think he felt a bit trapped by maybe under Conte, and the sort of the insistence on automatisms that they talked about under Conte. Yeah, I think that's helping the team going forward. I think that Chelsea have perhaps not had a game yet where they are up against one of the real contenders in this league, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how they look in that sort of situation. Obviously against Arsenal, frailties at the back were exposed, and I think that there may be some frailties at the back, especially in this back forward, David Luiz. But yeah, you can't fault a team that's won four games out of four, can you?
I was actually quite impressed with Bournemouth, Barry.
Yeah, they had chances. Gosling had a good effort that went narrowly wide. Callum Wilson missed one he should have scored from 6 or 7 yards out. He somehow put it over the bar. I'd have put the house on them bagging that one. And they have impressed me so far this season, even though I think, as usual, I tipped them to get relegated. I don't think there's a hope in hell of them going down, because they've been very impressive so far.
Should Alonso have been sent off? Because he was booked, and then Bournemouth wanted to take a quick throw and he sort of jumped in the way. And it was, you know, it was a bit of shithousery from him. It might have been soft, but
he could have had no complaints if he'd got another yellow for that. I suspect if he wasn't already on a yellow, he would have got booked. Mm. And so, yeah, he should have gone, and the score was still nil-nil when that happened, and he was one of the best players on the pitch again.
And there was a moment where Giroud pushed, I think it might have been Ryan Fraser was running through, in one of those. There's a fine line between shepherding the ball out and basically just throwing someone on the floor who's near the ball. And they're never given, but actually Bournemouth could have got a penalty there too.
Giroud likes doing that type of thing, doesn't he? The rough stuff, I suppose you call it. Sarri talks about how he thought Marcus Alonso could be the best left-back in the world, which I thought was interesting.
Who else is up there?
Marcello is the one that springs to mind.
But he's, ostensibly an attacker.
Yeah, but
I think that goes for a lot of the people who we think of as the better fullbacks nowadays, doesn't it? You know, the ones who stand out, at least the ones who get the recognition, are often the ones who get forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think Alonso is a very good player, and has actually already seems to have taken to Sarri's management. There was a number I picked out for today's paper. Actually, if we're talking about writing the paper. 418, the number of passes Jorginho has attempted for Chelsea. That's more than any other player in Europe.
How many has he... What's his?
I think it's 383 that he's completed.
Oh, that's not bad, is it? In Europa League, Chelsea have got Pauk, Bate Borisov and VDFC from Hungary. So, any thoughts on that, Barry?
Not one.
Watford 2, Spurs 1. Mark says, how are you all going to celebrate Watford's title win? Paul says, will the movie of Watford's title season count as part of the Leicester movie franchise? And Samwise the Board says, does Barry have any World Cup honey left? And if so, is he up for a naked jog round Trafalgar Square if Watford win the league this season? It was a good... I don't know. I just thought it was a sign of why Spurs won't win the league. In a game that looked really easy to win, Watford just upped it a bit physically and Spurs sort of crumbled.
Well, I've been very impressed with Watford's work ethic. And I saw a couple of stats this morning where 8.2 seconds is the average time opponents keep the ball before Watford win it back from them. And only Manchester City and Chelsea get the ball back quicker. And only Manchester City keep opponents further from their own goal on average. And that suggests Watford players are very fit. They're working hard for their manager and they've bought into his ethic. And that's obvious as well from their results. I thought I would be a bit critical of Mauricio Pochettino. I know it's heresy for journalists to criticise Maurizio Pochettino, but I thought he got his team selection wrong and maybe underestimated Watford. He played a back three. Moussa Dembele was the lone defensive midfielder, and he had Dele Alli and Christian Eriksen either side of him, and he was overrun, I think, by a lot of by the Watford midfield, and that was a huge contributing factor to Spurs' defeat. And also they conceded both goals from set pieces, which isn't good enough.
No, and interesting, those set pieces, neither Deeney nor Cathcart had to move. I mean, they just stood totally still.
Yeah.
And I guess sometimes with set pieces, the ball's just in the right place, isn't it? I mean...
Yeah, a couple of great balls from Hollabas, unquestionably, who Troy Deeney gives sort of weirdly, like... it felt like it was supposed to be a joke about, oh, we won't give him too much credit because he complains all the time, but somehow it came off a little bit moody, actually, in his post-game conference. I mean, I really enjoy Troy Deeney sometimes. Like when he's in this sort of mood, you mentioned physicality. There was sort of shortly before Watford's first goal, Davinson Sanchez goes in for a shoulder to shoulder with him and just winds up sort of flat on his face on the floor because Deeney just shrugs him off basically and then turns around and puts a cross in. And I think it was Alderweireld put it against his own bar. Yeah, like sort of in the air and in sort of those physical challenges, there are times when he seems unplayable, when he just seems to treat defenders like they're I don't know, made of paper or something. He's really sort of physically imposing at times, and when he gets in that mode, well, Tottenham certainly couldn't handle it very well at all. At the other end, it was the same story. I think the stat was 32 crosses for Tottenham, only 6 of them found their target, and that was mostly just as simple as, yeah, winning your individual aerial battles, and Watford were better on those all game.
Harry Kane, it almost seems to... hasn't looked like the Harry Kane, and almost since the Colombia game in the World Cup. He's clearly a lovely footballer. He takes up the right positions. He's got a good touch, but... doesn't seem to be getting away from defenders, doesn't seem to be taking those chances.
He got away from Phil Jones last Monday.
Well, that is, okay, it's a good point.
Well, I think he's still, I mean, actually, I think he was guilty, wasn't he, for the first Watford goal. Him and Dele Alli let the goal scorer go. But in the air, he still seems to be okay. I'm a bit concerned that already he's turned into sort of late period Alan Shearer, where Alan Shearer was absolutely imperious in the air but couldn't get around the rest of the pitch. I think actually, you say that Colombia game, I think the injury he had, you know, mid-season that they rushed him back from, he's never been quite the same since then. I mean, if we set aside the Panama performance, and he did play very well against Colombia, Harry Kane hasn't quite been himself for quite a while. One of the other things is that he likes to drop. When things aren't quite going for Spurs, he likes to drop maybe a little bit too deep. And one of the things I am told is that those that know Kane say that he thinks that he is more of a creative player than he is a goal scorer. Now, let's face it, he's probably the best goal scorer in the English game, so you must think he's one hell of a playmaker. I don't think my not particularly learned view is that get yourself up front, Harry. That's where you'll do the damage.
I saw some numbers on this that were interesting, which is sort of supports what John's saying in terms of maybe he thinks he's trying to play a different role, but also would support the theory in my mind that he's just a bit fatigued. Last season, averaging 5 shots per game. Season before that, it was 3.7. Season before that, 4.2. So far this season, he had 2.5 shots per game. The World Cup with England, it was only 2.3 shots per game. England's a bit of a different story, obviously, you know, different team, how many opportunities you get, completely different situation. But I think there's something in that sort of this season for Tottenham. And look, he's still scoring goals, you just said, against Man United. But there's something in that maybe he's, whether sort of willingly taking on a different role and consciously doing it, or whether it's because Lucas Moura is in there more and is playing closer to him and is taking away some of those opportunities from him, or just because he's tired, the fact is that he is taking less shots.
Danny says, if England had introduced compulsory national service with exemptions for winning the World Cup, would the boys have brought it home this summer? This is clearly with reference to Heung-min Son, who's won the Asian Games, set up both goals in extra time against Japan, who scored late on. It was a 2-1 win. So Son won't have to do national service, Barry.
Yes, and that it's good for him and it's good for Tottenham, but not so good for the South Korean military, who will struggle now if they go to war and need someone pacey on the flanks in a pincer movement.
Spurs have Barcelona, PSV Eindhoven and Inter in their Champions League group. I guess Spurs, John, shouldn't fear going to the Nou Camp if they didn't fear going to the Bernabeu last year? Or should they? I mean, obviously they should.
I think the thing to say is that Spurs probably don't think that they're going to win the Champions League just yet. But that beating Real Madrid last season was such a big moment for the club. It was actually something rather mocked by the rest of fans that got this thing. There's a lot of people saying, oh, well, as Barry alluded to, there's too much praise for Maurizio Pochettino. They beat a poor Real Madrid team and all that. But still, beating Real Madrid, possibly beating Barcelona, would be great. It still feels to me, despite what went on at Watford, that Spurs are still on the exciting part of the journey before things go a little bit stale. But we'll have to see. The thing is, you can't get jaded about playing Barcelona in the Champions League, can you?
No, I mean, it's the whole point of getting into the competition.
That's why it's there. That's why the competition is created in the way that it is, yeah.
Inter, thoughts, Paolo?
Well, they were supposed to be the team that would challenge Juventus to the title of the season so far. Been looking still very much like a work in progress, very much still Inter, who have a habit of shooting themselves in the foot. I expect Tottenham, I think Tottenham are just further along in their development than Inter are. Inter, they've got back into the Champions League, and that in itself was sort of huge after more than half a decade out of it. But they're a long way, I would say, off where Tottenham are in terms of their development towards really being able to compete at the very highest level. That said, I will also add that I thought exactly the same thing about Roma last season when they drew Atletico Madrid and Chelsea, and they completely surprised me. So you never know.
Burnley 0, Manchester United 2. David says, do you have anything to talk about with United winning and Jose smiling, Barry? What's this done for the narrative?
Well, Jose made the same point, really, in his post-match press conference. He it was one of those times where a manager makes a joke that isn't particularly funny, and then all the journalists who were present laugh uproariously and slap their thighs as if they're at a Chris Rock gig or something. Jose said, you know, it would have been better for you if we'd lost, because, you know, along the same lines, I don't think he used the word narrative, but anyway. I expected Manchester United to win that game. Burnley look a shadow of the Burnley that has been so obdurate and hard to beat in recent years, and they're making defensive errors that are very uncharacteristic from a Sean Dyche side, and I kind of worry that it's going to be hard for them to get their mojo back. But yeah, it would have been a huge upset if Manchester United had lost, and yes, the narrative would have continued. We'd have been subjected to more and more Jose, where has it all gone wrong articles. Particularly now that we're into an international break, which are traditionally slow for news. So, but yeah, I wasn't surprised United won. Andy, but like everyone else, I was really hoping they wouldn't.
Andy says, with there being a lot of specialist coaching roles in football, is it time we got a headbutting coach? Because footballers are terrible at it. Pretty sure the punishment is the same, so may as well do it properly, be professional about it. It was some excellent baiting from Bardsley on Rashford, wasn't it? And Rashford took the bait.
He got absolutely kippered there, didn't he? And the thing is, Marcus Rashford is quite a lot younger than Phil Bardsley, but you know, Phil Bardsley is a Salford lad, played for United. He's probably well known around the club, good friends with Wayne Rooney, and Phil probably laughed his head off that they actually got away with that. And he actually did a sort of Beckham on Simeone sort of flick, didn't he? And only got a yellow card for that.
He should have got a red shirt.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
For the initial kick, like leaving aside the fact that he also sort of does the head, you know, the head knock, but the head push back on Rashford. He also just like he kicks him a good way out of bounds, like very deliberately. Like it's a red card offence.
I think we need to. It should be the rutting stag. That's what I believe the phrase should be for a headbutt where. There's no backlift, is there? I mean, we always praise footballers for having no backlift, but with a headbutt, there's two types. There's attaching the head and then pushing, which is what Rashford did, or there's really swinging back and going for it. Another two.
I don't think a proper headbutt. I've never headbutted anyone in my life, but I don't think you signposted that clearly, because then it makes.
Oh, well, you just go in. You just, yeah, it's got a lot of front force, has it?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. I'd need to watch Trainspotting and see the master Begbie in action again to remind myself. But if, yeah, any headbutting experts out there are welcome to post under the line or tweet us and let us know.
So someone who's got real. If you could send us your headbutting stats as well. If you connect at the same time, presumably it hurts you just as much as it hurts them, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, don't you go for the bridge of the nose and then...
Okay. I mean, for someone who doesn't know about it, you seem to know a lot about it.
It's like one of those things, like pole vaulting. How do you start practicing headbutting?
You just do it on a wall at home.
Yeah.
If anybody's headbutted a wall in practice, please let us know. Another two for Lukaku. And Pogba had his penalty saved. And there is an issue if you run up very slowly. You really need to... I mean, you obviously need to score any penalty. Yeah. You know, just because Charlie Austin ran up quickly doesn't mean his penalty misses... is any better, but it just doesn't look as bad.
Yeah, Pascal Gross did the same, didn't he? Someone on Twitter, I should credit him, Paul McDonald, talks about Lukaku's goal since March. Listen to this roll of honour. Two against Brighton, one against Swansea, one against Bournemouth, two against Saudi Arabia, one against Egypt, two against Costa Rica, two against Panama, two against Tunisia, two against Burnley.
Flat track bully, is that what you're saying?
Well, that was what Paul said in the next bit of the... now, I was obviously being part of the biased mainstream media against Manchester United. Maybe we deal in this post-factual era, but that does say a little bit about Lukaku, who actually should have had about five goals yesterday. I think he has done a good job for Manchester United. I think he's actually one of those players who Jose Mourinho has improved. But... still, there are those moments when you think you have to do better than that.
The banner, which criticised Ed Woodward, Barry, and Jose afterwards said, you know, this was a victory for Ed Woodward. How do we feel the banner went down? A great success?
Well, it went up, yeah. As these banners tend to do, trailed by an aeroplane. I worry about the mental health of people who commission these things, and... I'm not sure any of them have ever done any good. It's a waste of money from idiots with who clearly have more money than sense.
I believe it flew during the minute silence for Jimmy McIlroy, Burnley's greatest ever player, so well done there. And also, this is the thing I always remembered about these, and maybe I've misremembered this, but before these planes flew, they were supposed to be a surprise, and that you'd see them, and then the message would be made clearer. But we've been hearing about this banner for about the last 3 weeks, that it was going to say this about Ed Woodward, and they've got their own PR message, and, you know, why don't you just do the PR message and then not spend the money on the plane?
It's a very good point. I mean, you've already said you're angry about it. You don't, in the social media world, you don't need an aeroplane with a big sign on it.
I mean, I didn't even need to look at the picture of what it said because I knew what it was going to say.
I just remember aeroplane banners being more in... aren't they just... yeah. In films like Jaws, they're flying over on the beach before the sharks appeared, advertising some kind of... you know, that's what they did before you could advertise on people's phones.
Yeah, marry me, Karen, or something like that. You know,
exactly.
Then another plane heaves into view. I learnt this last week. There's no such word as hoves.
Okay.
With the word no on it.
Manchester United have Juventus, Valencia and Young Boys in their group, Route H of the Champions League. Ronaldo returns to Old Trafford, Paolo.
Yeah, and he hasn't scored yet. Can you believe it, Max? Three games without a goal. It's so unprecedented, Ronaldo opening a season going three games without a goal and taking precisely 23 shots to not score a goal, that he did exactly the same thing last season.
That'll do for part one. We'll do the rest of the Premier League in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Gaz says, is it worth putting the reserves out for today's pod with the view of performing in Manchester on Wednesday, or are you treating Wednesday in Manchester as the Carabao Cup? It's our live show. A few tickets still available. Producer Jonathan, when I say a few, do I mean 10 or do I mean 568? He scratches his head. We don't know. Anyway, come and see us in Manchester. Me, you, Barry, Sid and Lars.
Yeah.
Is that how you're selling it?
Well, I'm looking forward to it. It should be good. And
Lars is bringing a euphonium. Oh, no. Lars says if anyone has a euphonium, he'll play it.
Yeah.
Okay. Oslo, the 19th of September. Me, you and Lars. And then Wilson joins us. So if you are in Norway, come. Or if you have enough money to buy an aeroplane banner, Don't spend it on that. Fly to Norway and watch us there. Manchester City 2, Newcastle 1. Pep did say they wouldn't be firing for a while because of the World Cup, as you sort of mentioned already, John, about some other teams. Paolo, do you think that's the case with City?
I mean, because we sort of touched them just at the end of the last segment with Juventus. It's that thing of being a top club that's not firing and you're still unbeaten after four games. You know, generally, you know, this weekend they won all right. They didn't play as well as perhaps they're at their peak capable of, but they still won. Does it matter? I don't know. It seems like they're sort of such a champagne problems to me.
I had Carl Walker's strike. He doesn't score often, but it was an absolutely beautiful strike. The first time you see it, you think, the keeper's got to do better, hasn't he? But actually, it was beautiful, I thought.
Both of their goals were sort of finishes that you just think, oh, well, that's why you win leagues and beat everyone. Because even if you're not playing that well, you've just got players who can do things that are really, really technically impressive. I mean, yeah, it was a beautiful strike from Kyle Walker.
Newcastle, Barry. I thought the run from Yedlin was, you know, that is somebody who was absolutely desperate to get on the end of that cross, and it was for a while.
It went untracked as well, which, you know, I would imagine Pep Guardiola would have been furious about. I think it was
Gabriel Jesus, I think.
What was it? Yeah. That didn't track him. I mean, Newcastle adopted much the same tactics as they did against Chelsea. They only had 22% possession, and much like the game against Chelsea, they almost got away with it. Jamal Lascelles was back from the doghouse or wherever he's been, and it was his foolish error that giving the ball away that led to City's first. And when you're setting up your stall like that, you can't afford silly mistakes like that. I thought, you know, it was a pretty boring game to watch, as most had predicted, but you can't blame Newcastle for adopting those tactics. And again, I think they're quite unfortunate not to have got more points on the board so far.
Michael says, at what point should Rafa just give up? He's good, but Newcastle haven't got the squad to really do anything, and to an extent need another teams to be worse than them so they can stay up. Surely that can't be fulfilling for a man of God's stature.
Of what stature?
God stature.
Well, God's stature in Newcastle, yeah. I mean, they have had actually three difficult games as... they play Tottenham, Chelsea, Manchester City, and those are the games in which Rafa Benitez throughout his career would adopt those tactics. I think the truth of where Newcastle are going to be is when they start playing like Burnley and, actually can't say this anymore, Watford, and to see where they're at then. Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, Rafa Benitez is in that sort of purgatorial situation at Newcastle, isn't he? You've got those that argue that Mike Ashley has done a good job, most of them in the media, and who may or may not have business interests, which are in tandem with Sports Direct. And then there are those that suggest that he's running a club which is run on a sort of 0 hours, you know, down to the bone method of managing the club and owning the club. It's very difficult for Rafa. I think his reputation has been increased by the job he's done at Newcastle, but there may come a point where he has had enough. And I think, actually, he's only got a year left on his contract, hasn't he? I wouldn't be surprised to see him walk at the end. And, you know, he would be... I imagine that the people of Newcastle might hold some sort of street festival to wave him off or send him off in some sort of longboat for the job that he's done there. But yes,
I hope they do.
That would be good, wouldn't it?
And Salomon Rondon will be fired with Salomon Rondon will be tasked with the job of shooting the flaming arrow towards the longboat, and we just repeatedly miss.
The longboat heads out down the Tyne into the North Sea. Yeah.
City have got Shakhtar Donetsk, Lyon, and Hoffenheim in their Champions League group, which, on the face of it, looks relatively straightforward for them. Cardiff 2, Arsenal 3. This was a fun game, wasn't it? And we mentioned Alisson at the top of the pod, Paolo. Petr Cech is... he is great fun. I mean, it literally is just, you know, just not even trying to pass it to his own teammates, just giving it straight. I mean, there was the one, was it for Harry Arter, got a chance, which he should have scored. you sort of imagine Petr Cech has created more chances for Cardiff than any Cardiff player has this season.
Well, yeah, this is the difference, right? Alisson made a mistake this weekend, but has shown himself in his career so far to be extremely good for a goalkeeper with the ball at his feet. Petr Cech looks as uncomfortable as a man can look with this idea of having to put his creative imprint on Arsenal's play from the back. Unai Emery does not seem to want to shy away from it anyway, and managers like Neil Warnock are going, oh, okay, this is a way that we can unsettle Arsenal, and doing so very effectively. Yeah, I mean, it was what led to the first goal. It was a very clear part of Cardiff's game plan, and it made a game that on paper shouldn't have been that close with how much more of the ball Arsenal had shake out very close indeed.
I feel really sorry for Petr Cech. You know, after he's done a really bad, what's he meant to do? What face is he meant to pull? He just sort of stands there going...
Watching him struggle with this, it reminded me of the time I tried to show my father how to use the internet. And he'll either get the hang of it, as Sam eventually did, but he had to do a course, or, you know, he won't and will just give up and someone else will take over. So, you know, I wouldn't give up on him just yet. But yeah, maybe send him to do a course to someone more qualified and with more patience than I have.
Do you think Edison does that? Edison does, you know, you could do like a Monday night training school.
Well, my dad went to learn how to use the internet. It was a friend of mine who was doing the teaching, and yeah, I think he tried his patience as well.
Aubameyang and Lacazette do look great, and they're entertaining. They're fun footballers, aren't they, John?
Yes, I did this game for minute by minute yesterday, and Lacazette was excellent throughout. First start of the season. But him and Aubameyang, it seems, get off the pitch, get on very well. Shades of Dwight York, Andy Cole. Maybe not. Let's leave some tabloid stuff out of there. But yeah, they were interviewed afterwards, and they seem to be really enjoying each other's company out there. Obviously, this strike duo is something that is an absolute rarity these days, and it was quite a brave selection, really, from Unai Emery. Actually, something I pick up from this game, Neil Warnock, it's not defeatist, but he's sort of talking about how life is so very hard for him, but he's going to try and enjoy himself. And during this game, you can actually hear it on the TV mic, him joking away with the fourth official, just sort of saying, oh, this is a great game, this, isn't it? And you could also hear him haranguing the referee, Anthony Taylor, saying, there's another team playing, you know, Anthony, and all this type of thing. What I did notice is that Arsenal picked up a lot of bookings because Neil Warnock knows how to get his team to tempt the other team into committing fouls. And Cardiff are going to... There's going to be ructions in several games this season. I think the one thing is Paolo talks about the fact that they pressed Petr Cech, but I think the funny thing is they didn't keep that up throughout the game. And if they'd have kept pushing further forward, maybe they don't possess the energy levels, they perhaps could have got a bit more out of the game than the two goals. Neil Warnock had a great time, was hugely entertained, but he could have got a point out of this game.
Actually, I heard Sean Dyche, I think you could hear, off mic as well.
Oh, screaming. Yes, I heard that. Because like the normal sort of gruff voice... When he's actually shouting full volume, it's really frightening noise.
It's amazing,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I just wanted to pick up on the Lacazette Aubameyang thing, because I think Lacazette, when Aubameyang came in, you think about the position he's in as a striker who sort of was signed originally as, I guess, the guy to start up front, and to have that happen, a player could take that in a very different way to how he's taken it. A player could take that as a negative. This guy's coming to take my job, and that's it. And it feels like Lacazette's done the exact opposite. And actually, I saw this. Just this morning, that his last five starts now is five goals and two assists. Like he's thriving in it. He seems so energized by Aubameyang being there, and I think that's sort of definitely the optimistic look at this Arsenal team. Right? I mean, the defensive is just atrocious in large parts of this game, but yeah, the potential to have something sort of exciting between those two is the clear upside right now.
Arsenal have drawn Sporting Karabag and FC Vorskla of Ukraine in the Europa League. Sam Dean of The Telegraph has worked out the maths. They'll be travelling 9,928 miles for their three away games. Baku, almost 5,000 miles. Poltava, almost 3,000. And Lisbon, just under 2,000 miles. So that's... they can watch some movies on the plane, can't they? Paolo, you just want to mention the celebration.
Well, there's a couple of political things going on, actually. In the Europa League, one of those games, of course, in Azerbaijan, and Henrik Mkhitaryan's ability to there is going to be interesting because of sort of ongoing disputes between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Armenian citizens, Armenian passport holders not welcome currently in Azerbaijan, and whether or not they'll make an exemption, whether or not Arsenal would risk the security element of bringing him along. It's one part of it, but not the only sort of political consideration with Arsenal right now, because of course we saw after the first goal from Mustafi off a Xhaka cross, he made the Albanian eagle gesture, which was sort of brought to the public attention during the World Cup with Switzerland. We know that Swiss players were fined for making that gesture. Mustafi, like Xhaka, has Albanian heritage, and we will have to wait and see if the FA, like FIFA, feel that this is a political gesture that needs to be punished with a fine.
West Ham 0, Wolves 1. First win for Wolves this season, Barry. I imagine more of the story will be about how West Ham have no points yet and could go quite a long time without having any points.
Yeah, they've some tough games coming up this month, and look to have secured their first point of the season with possibly their worst performance of the season. And until Adama Traore came off the bench and did his best impersonation of the Flash to go past, who was Cresswell in a blur and score a very, very late winner, which prompted boos in some sections of the London Stadium. According to the papers today, there is isn't any suggestion that West Ham are about to pull the trigger and get rid of Manuel Pellegrini, which possibly means they are about to pull the trigger and get rid of Manuel Pellegrini. But, yeah, it's worrying for West Ham fans, but probably not hugely surprising, because I think even when they were spending 100 million during the summer, they were making West Ham signings that nobody had a huge amount of confidence.
I keep getting fooled by them. I keep going, oh, these signings actually look quite sensible. You look at their fixtures. They've got Everton away, Chelsea home, Man United at home, Brighton away, Spurs home, Leicester away, Burnley home in November. And actually, at the moment, you sort of think Burnley at home in November is the first game you might predict a victory for them.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Tony Cascarino, and you two know well, say, just compare Pellegrini's reign to that of Frank de Boer last season. You know, he was sacked after four games. It's not quite at that crisis point just yet, but there is this point where Pellegrini has taken to blaming what's gone at the club under David Moyes and Slaven Bilic, and also the signings that they've made. I mean, it's bad saying this, it feels bad saying this, but poor old Jack Wilshere, you know, hauled off, I think, after 62 minutes, completely exhausted. Looks like he's running in glue. Probably needs to be much more fitter than he is, or definitely needs to be much more fitter than he is. And you start to worry about his long-term prospects as a footballer, which is very sad considering the talent that he has. And throughout that team, there are several players where you think, why are you still at the club? And the players that you brought in, why did they bring them into the club? It's classic West Ham. I mean, you have this situation in the Premier League or English football where it used to be that at a certain point, one of West Ham, Newcastle or Manchester City were at crisis at a certain point. Everton were always around there or thereabouts. Now Manchester City are a totally different club. You've got Newcastle and you've got West Ham. Now Newcastle is sort of a flatlining state of situation. So it's good to have West Ham being exactly what we expect, the crisis club. And this is the start of the season that we might have expected from them anyway, because it's West Ham.
Alan Shearer was incredibly critical of them on Match of the Day, you know, showing just that the players seem to have given up already. They're just one walking around, jogging, no intensity, no apparent desire. And their best player by far this season has been the goalkeeper, Lukas Fabianski. And I think but for him on Saturday, they'd have lost by a hell of a lot more.
Brighton 2, Fulham 2. Fulham 2 up, threw it away. Lots of defensive mistakes in this game. An utterly ridiculous handball from Mitrovic. There's no idea what he's doing. You could see when his teammates just all put their hands on their heads going, what are you doing then? But I'm still so impressed by Glenn Murray, who's 35 now and bullies defenders.
Well, he's 35 this month.
Okay.
He's still 34.
Okay, still 34. My point still stands.
Yes, it does, yes.
It's very
impressive. Hoping we were going to revisit that famous Twitter argument.
Yes. He's 28.
No, he's not. Does anybody want to be impressed like I am with Glenn Murray?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, remember a year ago or so, people were saying Glenn Murray should be in the England team. He doesn't have the sufficient pace for that. But when he took the penalty, actually, Pascal Gross, as we talked about before, took this penalty where he delayed, and then sold the goalkeeper exactly where he was going to get put it. Whereas Glenn Murray just gave it some Workington, Carlisle, Rochdale values and just smashed it. And it wasn't particularly the best penalty, but he hit it hard. And actually, the first goal that he scored, intelligent run, neat finish. Glenn Murray is, you know, he's getting better with age, isn't he? That's the thing.
He is. I think both these teams add a lot to the Premier League.
And just one stat that I did hear is that no player has committed more fouls than Glenn Murray since the start of last season, and he leads the chart in fouls committed this season.
Is he the new Kevin Davis?
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Seems he is.
Would that statistic count offsides?
No.
No.
So it's just actual fouls?
Yeah. Palace 0, Southampton 2. Mark Hughes' first win at Selhurst Park as manager. They deserved it as well. Lovely finish from Danny Ings. Barry, are you disappointed that we can't hear you moaning about Mark Hughes moaning about officials?
Oh, he was very complimentary of his team and they played well. I was surprised Palace didn't put up more of a fight, to be honest. They were, considering they were playing at home, it was pretty poor performance. Roy Hodgson didn't try to defend it. And again, the ongoing decline of Christian Benteke, who's clearly has his confidence is completely shot, and he missed another sitter on Saturday. You know, late in the game, just before Southampton scored their second. What do you do with him? I really don't know. His confidence is gone. There's a Norwegian striker at Palace, Alexander Sorloff, who has replaced him in each game he's played so far and scored in the Carabao Cup midweek. So unless he was injured, I would be sure he'd start. The only positive for Palace fans on that front, I think, is Conor Wickham is due back at some stage soon. And if he can bang in a few, then that would probably signal the end of Benteke as their first choice striker.
Everton 1, Huddersfield 1. Disappointing result for Everton, really. Paolo, about Huddersfield showing a bit of fight. I think everyone's just written Huddersfield off this season, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think teams with more options than Everton might find more ways to break them down. Everton were missing a lot of players in this game. I think something like 8 players out through injury and mostly injury and suspension. So perhaps not at their sort of absolute maximum of their capacity in those terms. But yeah, you know, Huddersfield. I suppose it's interesting, isn't it? You can sort of draw a contrast with the Neil Warnock approach, which is apparently, well, whatever, let's have fun. Or, you know, let's be pragmatic and grind out results where we have to, and we'll see where that shakes out by the end of the season.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see who the three worst teams are in this division, because you wonder how low a points tally you'll need to survive. Certainly it'll be less than 40, I think. In exciting, they're not English news, Phil Billing, Huddersfield scorer, sounds like he must be from Rotherham, is Danish, 100% Danish. He's the next Josh King.
Well, shades of Martin Braithwaite, yeah.
Mm, there we are. Oh, yeah, Braithwaite's another good one, isn't he? In the Football League, in the Championship, the top two, Leeds and Middlesbrough, drew 0-0 on Friday night at Elland Road. Sheffield United up to third after hammering Villa 4-1. Derby a fourth after a late winner at Hull. And a late strike by Ollie Watkins gave fifth place Brentford the points at home to Nottingham Forest. While Ellis James, who's in on Thursday, I believe, had a nice time as Swansea won 2-1 at Millwall, despite being down to 10 men from the fifth minute.
I don't think he did have a nice time because he was at the game and wearing a highly visible green jacket, and a gang of Millwall fans spotted him and spent much of the match shouting, "Who's the wanker in the green?" his way. So,
oh, we'll find out on Thursday. Reading are bottom. They have 2 points. They lost at home to Sheffield Wednesday. Ipswich are second bottom also. They've got 3 points. They drew 1-1 on Sunday at Portman Road against Norwich in the East Anglian derby. In League One, Peterborough's 100% record is over, thank goodness. They're still top, unfortunately, after a 1-1 draw with Doncaster. Level on points at Portsmouth. They won the Naval Derby with Plymouth 3-0. Plymouth are bottom in League Two. Lincoln are top. They won 3-0 at Exeter. Newport second after a 2-1 win at Port Vale. MK Dons are third. They drew 1-1 at Swansea. Notts County bottom on 1 point. Lost 3-1 at home to Forest Green a week after sacking Kev Nolan. And Cambridge won 1-0 at Stevenage. Yes. Fit Bar Barry. It was the Old Firm derby. It was a frenetic game of violence and kicking, and Celtic came out on top.
Yeah, it was a pretty chaotic affair, and I don't think the result or the scoreline quite does the manner in which the game played out justice, because Celtic were vastly superior, and it was, must have been a bit of a kick in the teeth for Rangers fans, who I think were cautiously optimistic after such a good start to the season. They were unbeaten in 12 under Steven Gerrard. This was unlucky 13. Alan McGregor in goal for Rangers was outstanding, helped keep the score down, and shouldn't be on the field really, because he kicked out at Christopher Adja and should have seen red. And Steven Gerrard was... Oh, Celtic also, I think, hit the woodwork 3 or 4 times. There was one James Forrest volley that was would have been a contender for goal of the season if it had gone in. He rattled the crossbar. And after the match, Steven Gerrard was very critical of the referee, who didn't spot a Tom Rodgick foul on Rodney Jack in the build-up to the winning goal. And he claims that the fourth official told the ref it was a foul on 3 different occasions, and the ref, Willie Collum, just ignored him. So, but, you know, to blame the ref for that defeat is slightly disingenuous, because Rangers did get a battering. They had a couple of chances, but couldn't score. There was also, before the game started, some Celtic fans were injured in a bit of a crush on the way in, and Celtic have promised to launch an inquiry. I don't think anyone was seriously hurt, but it was slightly worrying.
In other Fitbar news, has anyone else seen the brilliant officiating in Partick Thistle, Greenock Morton? Partick won 1-0, but they scored a goal where Chris Doolan hit a ball from the edge of the box. It hit the underside of the bar, went into the goal. They went all off and cheered. A centre-back, in rage, just kicked it out of the stand, and the linesman gave a throw-in. And the ref went over to chat to the linesman, awarded a throw-in. And the best thing, I retweeted this the other day, if you want to go and find it, or you can find it anywhere, is the commentator's total bemusement. They literally got no idea what's happening. And there's just no way they can give a throw-in. So the attacking side are like, how are we taking a throw-in? The whole thing is brilliant. Thistle manager Alan Archibald described it as bizarre and unbelievable, but it didn't matter because they won anyway. And that will do for part two. In part three, we'll start with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Barcelona 8, Huesca 2. That sounds fun.
It does, and the best thing about it was Huesca scored first. And at that point, you're thinking, blimey, this is really... Then Barcelona get themselves back into the lead before half-time, but it's 3-2 at half-time, and there's a real sense that, God, this year, Barcelona could kind of get caught out here, and then it finishes 8-2. There's not really a lot else to say. It finishes 8-2. They were very, very good in the second half. which I was actually watching from Betis' stadium in Seville. But Messi was fantastic again. And there's signs that Barcelona, when they go forward, are starting to get it right. Although Valverde did admit after the game, the manager, that he's worried about the goals they're letting in.
Sid, I saw somewhere today Huesca's budget for last season was 9 million euros. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like kicking a blind man's stick, isn't it?
Well, I mean, there's a little bit of that. I mean, obviously what happens, of course, as soon as you go up into the first division, everybody's budget leaps. And I think in Huesca's case, it's leaped from, I think, 9 to just over 50, because you basically, you automatically go up to about 42, 43, I think, just on TV revenue alone. But yeah, they're a long, long way behind. But they are either the smallest or the second smallest team in the first division, along with Eibar. They played Eibar on the first day, and I was at that. And it was very interesting as well, because, you know, Eibar, in a way, you spend your entire history trying to get in the first division. Although even that's not true, because Huesca were a team that never even aspired to be in the first division until 4 or 5 years ago. When you get there, you think, wow, Madrid, Barcelona, and you get Eibar, the smallest team, a team with a stadium of barely 7,000. But actually, it was very interesting that first day, because there was a real sense of Huesca trying to take lessons from Eibar. You know, this is how you survive in a division where, as you say, it should be like, you know, kind of kicking someone. It should be just too easy for the big clubs. But Eibar have survived and survived well and been close to European places. And Huesca are clearly a very well-run club. But yeah, of course, in terms of resources, it's not even close.
A straightforward win for Real Madrid against Leganés. Atletico lost 2-0 at Celta Vigo. That's a surprise, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a big surprise. And I think it fits into there's been this kind of sense over the summer, because of the amount of money that Atletico Madrid has spent, because of the kind of players they've signed, because they've kept Griezmann and Jan Oblak as well, that actually they were under pressure this year. And for the first time, they were under pressure to play well, to genuinely be title contenders. And I think, you know, I include myself in this at the start of the season, we were thinking, no, they're probably more title contenders now than they were the season they won it, which was felt like a miracle at the time. And then they're already now 5 points behind both Madrid and Barcelona. They weren't good at all. Simeone took full responsibility for it afterwards. I say they weren't good. There were patches certainly in the first half where I thought they played okay. But they find themselves adrift already. Now that's not to say it's over, but it's a hell of a start for them. And this is basically what destroyed Real Madrid last year. Was a dreadful start to be already 5 points down. It's a big step.
And you're at the Seville derby, a vintage goal scorer, Sid.
Yeah, Joaquin Sanchez, who the day before, after training, he'd sat down with the manager. He hadn't played yet this season because of a calf injury, and he sat with the manager, and the manager said to him, "So, what do you reckon? How are you feeling?" He said, "Still not ready. It's not quite right." He wasn't convinced. The manager said, "Look, 15, 20 minutes at the end, when we need you to open up the game, you won't have to run back too much." So, yeah, go on then. Okay. Comes on 5 minutes later, scores the goal. It's the first time he scored in the derby since 2002. It was the night he became the player at 37 years, and I think, I'm going to get this wrong, but I think 37 years and 43 days, the oldest goal scorer in an Andalusian derby in the first division ever, and his only second ever goal. The last time he scored was in 2002.
And a fun time for Vinicius Junior in a reserve game for Real between them and Atletico.
Yeah, what's happened with Vinicius is quite interesting. So obviously, Real Madrid signed him for, I believe, about 45 million euros. And they're playing him for the time being, training with the first team and playing him in Real Madrid Castilla, which, although in theory it's Real Madrid's youth team or sort of kind of B team, they play in the Segunda Division B, which is against normal teams, but there's other youth teams and stuff, well, other second teams in there. They were playing Atletico Madrid's B team at the weekend. He scored, one of the goals is brilliant. He scored an absolutely brilliant goal, but right at the end, and it does appear from reading the reports, I must confess I haven't seen the game because I was on my way to Seville, it does appear that they kind of laid into him a little bit, which tends to happen at that level. And then right at the end, he got bitten on the head.
Yeah, and
which, I mean,
really...
I don't know about you, but if you're going to bite something, you need something you can actually get your teeth into. Yeah, I mean, that's just bone, isn't it?
It is, but he really gets his mouth so wide to really clump onto the top of the head, doesn't he?
It's an incredible photo, because you're right, and you've got Vinicius, I mean, because they'd already kind of tumbled onto each other on the floor, so Vinicius is already looking at the referee and kind of going, "What on earth is this?" just at the moment that the bite happens, and so you've got this photo of him kind of going, "What's this?" And player behind, it's an extraordinary player. I mean, it is much more, I think, in terms of certainly the imagery, it's much more striking, for example, than those three Luis Suarez ones were, yeah, in terms of the imagery.
Yeah. We can recreate it with you and Barry on Wednesday night in Manchester.
Would it not make more sense to use a ham as Vinicius' head?
Absolutely.
Properly lick some of their teeth into it.
I can unhinge my jaw like an anaconda.
Just swallow Sid in part two. Yeah. Brilliant idea.
They can watch me slowly go down your body as your body kind of expands as I go down your...
Oh, performance throat. Art. Performance yeah. art and football chat in Manchester on Wednesday night.
It's the exit bit that worries me.
Well, I believe they'll have to cut me open from one end to the other.
Can we arrange that? Yeah, that would be quite fun.
Sid, lovely to talk to you. We'll see you on Wednesday.
Fantastic. Spain.
Cheers, pal. Cheers, Sid. Sidlo out in Spain. Italy, Paolo, give us a quick roundup.
Yeah, I feel like we've already sort of touched on some of the stories we were doing, the Champions League groups. Ronaldo still hasn't scored. Juventus still haven't dropped a point. They had a slightly trickier than maybe some would have imagined game away to Parma. Gervinho scoring Parma's goal, and actually, at that point, because there was 1-1 at that point, threatened to get another. Thought he was had a really nice game for Parma, and Juventus wobbled a little bit, but of course they came through it, and everyone is basically at the point already of assigning them the Scudetto, because Napoli got hammered 3-0 by Sampdoria. Absolutely outrageous backheel volley by Quagliarella for the third goal. Recommend that to anyone who's got the time to go and look it up, although actually Grégoire Defrel hit some certainly the first goal was a lovely strike as well. Napoli under Ancelotti, I can't decide, because some of these goals, like the Quagliarella goal, there's not an awful lot you can say about it, but they've had 6 shots on target against them this season and have conceded 6 goals. So David Ospina has been in goal for 5 of those. Not off to a flying start with Napoli, we can certainly say. Other than that, Inter finally get the first game win of the season. Raja Nainggolan, who has been missing for the first 2 games, obviously the big sign of the summer, scored their opening goal against Bologna, and so that was good for him to be off the mark, and the team winning without Mauro Icardi as well, so positive for them. Fiorentina, along with Juventus, the only team to have a perfect start so far, but they've only played 2 games. They beat Udinese 1-0. And the other big story for me, Sassuolo winning 5-3 against Genoa. Absolutely. I mean, it was some of these goals are atrocious acts of defending that lead up to them. But nevertheless, Sassuolo, 7 points after 3 games. They beat Inter, obviously, in their opener. And Kevin Prince-Boateng, who sort of seems like such an odd career he's had. You think he won the Scudetto with Milan in 2011, was a big part of that as well. He was right at the centre of the celebrations, doing his Michael Jackson dance, and very much like an integral part of that side. Has sort of gone on and had these nomadic years since. Seems to have sort of got back into something substantial when he helps Eintracht Frankfurt to win the cup last season in Germany. To go to Sassuolo, who are this... I think they had the 19th out of 20 clubs in terms of average attendance in Serie A last season. Not a club who are used to competing for things, but has been installed there at the front of attack. Had a tremendous game against Inter. Scored a 96th minute equaliser last weekend. Scored the opening goal here. It just seems to be reminding us of what a player he can be when he's switched on, which is a very good player indeed.
In the Bundesliga, let's get a report WhatsApp to us from Lukas Podolski's kebab shop. Here's Archie Rintutt.
2 weeks into the Bundesliga season and Bayern Munich have already assumed their position on top of the division. They won 3-0 away at Stuttgart in what was a Saturday evening stroll. Dortmund could have stayed top had they won at Hanover. Instead, they drew 0-0, Marco Reus hit the bar, and the highlight was an older gent in the stands trying to head the ball back into play during second half injury time. He did so successfully, before also successfully falling over and wiping out a small child in the process. A bit of a fail, much like Schalke's start to the season. Last year's runners-up remain on no points, after losing 2-0 at home to Hertha, who have surprisingly won both of their games so far this season. Leipzig have also got off to a poor start, just 1 point for them. They drew 1-1 at home with promoted Fortuna Düsseldorf. And completing the trio of big teams underperforming are Leverkusen, who I went to see on Saturday. They had some good news last week for 19-year-old Kai Havertz, who got his first call-up to the Germany squad. But he and his teammates have been tipped as title winners by some. They've now played 2, lost 2, after losing 3-1 at home to Wolfsburg, who were actually really quite good and have also got a 100% record. Maybe it's because of the squad's baby boom. because scorers at the weekend in Wout Weghorst and Renato Steffen are two of six squad members to have become dads in the last 6 weeks. Add in the team chef, and that number rises to seven, which brings you to the conclusion Wolfsburg had a productive winter break last year.
Thank you, Archie. In France, Neymar taunted the Nîmes fans after scoring his fourth goal of the season for PSG in a dramatic victory. Kylian Mbappe was sent off late on. The Brazilian ran over to a banner in the crowd, calling him a Chorona crybaby in Portuguese, and mimicked crying after opening the scoring. Dijon's 100% record's gone after a 2-0 home defeat to Cannes. Guingamp are doing a West Ham. They've got 0 points from their four games, losing 2-1 at home to Toulouse. England's women have qualified for the World Cup after a 3-0 win at Rodney Parade against Wales on Friday night. Second half goals from Tony Duggan, Jill Scott and Nikita Paris. The Welsh side had narrowed the pitch to make it as small as possible, but I mean, not all their players are professional, so the quality came through at the end. And that's pretty much it. We've got lots of questions, but since it's an international break, we can do them on Thursday's pod.
It's almost like you have to be somewhere.
I've got to go to work, Barry. Let me just read this. This is from Daniel Bosley. Dear Max and panel, I noticed the last couple of pods have included people writing in from obscure and isolated locations, thanking you for helping them retain their sanity. While I'm not entirely sure I can thank you for that, your voices are usually the only British ones I hear from week to week. I live on a small coral atoll called Aadhu, just below the equator in the middle of the Indian Ocean. While there used to be a British military base here, they all left in 1976, so that doesn't really help me. And as far as I'm aware, I'm the only Brit now living here. I normally listen while jogging at the local stadium, bordered by palm trees and next to the lagoon. It's slightly surreal, but definitely my favourite part of the week. Thanks for your work. I'll keep you updated on the sanity. Daniel Bosley, Hitherdoo Island, Aadhu City in the Maldives.
Sounds idyllic.
Yeah. We'll send.
I would also like to stress my voice is not British.
We could do a live show there, couldn't we?
If yeah, you
could
just fund, for Daniel.
If you could fund it, Daniel, we'll do a live show. Thanks for your time, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Paolo.
Cheers.
Thanks, John.
Cheers.
See you on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.